Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. This is our chance to get together and learn something from the week's events. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm happy to say my guests today are former Washington Attorney General Rob McKenna, Seattle Channel's Joni Balter, and attorney and activist Jossie Ross. Welcome back, everybody.
Good to see you.
Bill.
Happy
thank
Father's Day, all.
Yeah, thank you. We all know about the mass shooting in Orlando, Florida. People died again. Politicians debated again. What did it mean? Jossie, you and I were talking about our own accountability. What do you mean by that?
Well, when something like this happens, there's sort of this rush to make whomever the perpetrator of the evil act the face of evil in regards to this particular act. And I think there's also that's dangerous because sometimes there's a lessening of our own culpability, which is to say, to what degree do we make an atmosphere that allows things like this Orlando tragedy to happen? And looking at my own life, I know that there's certainly times when I've been a passive bystander to homophobic jokes, et cetera, mm-hmm. that may have or may not have. I don't know the ultimate conclusion of that, but created an environment where there's a certain amount of shame when you talk about this this shooter. There's a certain amount of hate. There's a certain amount of hate. There's a certain amount of repression of that, you know, of this, you know, he felt less than as a result of, you know, homosexuality. And I believe that there's times when I believe there's times when a lot of us help create that environment that creates that shaming.
I literally played Smear the Queer when I was in elementary school.
Yes.
You know,
I did too.
And by the way, we don't know everything about this, and I don't know when and if we will know everything about this man's sexuality, but that certainly has come up. What do we do about the Bible, though, and the Quran? Because this was what the shooter's father said. God himself, this is his version of tolerance, God himself will punish those involved in homosexuality. This is not for the servants of God. So isn't that, I mean, that's not going away unless we start ignoring ancient texts, right?
So that's one of the things that's just so overpowering about all of this. Myself, I have this feeling of just sadness that this response is somehow like the go-to template. If you are having mental problems, if you think you might be gay and your father feels like you just said, and your religion feels like you just said.
Billions of people feel like
this. Billions of people feel like this. And so if this is, you know, you're having troubles, but what is so disturbing and sad is that the redundant template for dealing with that problem that you are having is to go shoot 100 people. And, you know, it's sort of...
I can't tell whether it's a trend anymore. Are you saying, do you think it's becoming more and more...
Yes, I think it's becoming too routine. And then we all sit here and we try to parse, oh, what's the reason for the mental illness? But actually, the most important thing here is that we are enablers, all of us, who don't do anything about gun safety. And I know we'll get to that in more mm-hmm. detail, but I'm just saying the fact is it's just too darn easy for someone who is disturbed for all these reasons we're going over to just, oh, okay, I'll just go grab myself an assault-style weapon and go in and just act out, and then that somehow settles this. That's the craziest thing ever.
Rob McKenna, we've had a lot of shootings. Did anything happen this week that changes anything?
Yeah, I actually sense that we've reached a turning point, that even after horrific shootings like Sandy Hook, Aurora Movie Theater, San Bernardino, I think that this one felt different, and it felt different for two reasons. Maybe three reasons, but one of them obviously was the sheer number of victims.
Mm-hmm.
As many victims as we've seen in these other shootings, I mean, 50 dead and maybe more will pass if they don't survive, number one. Number two, the fact that there's this connection to ISIS. I think that this is the first time since San Bernardino, and we've seen that, but is that a pattern? Are we seeing that? But number three.
By connection, you mean
like
something that he shouted out?
It might be fake, but the initial, you asked me how I felt when
I heard about it.
And the initial reports were that he was shouting out things about ISIS, and ISIS took credit, was not taking credit, but was applauding what he did, right? But the third thing that felt different about this is just the cumulative weight of these incidents. Are they increasing in frequency, these really large-scale shootings? It may be. And that all of that together causes me to think we might be at a turning point on issues like controlling access to assault weapons.
What legislation would that result in? Because in the Senate, they didn't get very far.
They didn't, but now you're starting to see Republicans in the Senate say, you know, it is time to ban access to weapons for people who are on the FBI watch list if the bill is written in a way that protects due process, et cetera. You're seeing people step forward who need to come forward to provide, you know, leadership from the because they're coming from the side that has traditionally been very protective of the Second Amendment right to, you know, keep and bear arms. So, sometimes it takes more than one event before a political change occurs on particular policy. And, I could be wrong. Maybe nothing will happen this time either. But as soon as I heard about it and read the details, I thought, this time feels different. You might actually see something happen.
Well, gun control advocates would like to see a snowballing of what they would think of as tiny little incremental things like terrorist watch lists and expanded background checks. But where would you want to see – what's your vision for how we regulate guns?
Well, I think it does take a series of changes, and I think that the watch list example is a good example of an incremental change, but an important one that should be made. Number two, more universal background checks consistently across the country. Number three, fewer gaps in that system of background checks. In Washington State, we passed a bill in the legislature when I was attorney general addressing – access to firearms by people who were civilly committed under federal law and maybe under state law, but because the number of days of a commitment was different from federal to state, they might be banned from buying a weapon federally, but not by the state. We changed that. We closed that loophole. So I think that you're going to see more action at the state level and perhaps at the federal level regarding the mentally ill access to firearms. And it's just another example of an incremental change. And look, the fact is that gun control advocates would like to ban guns, period. They'd like us to become England. And that's not going to happen. But at the same time, there is support for tighter controls in certain ways by a majority of the public. And so that kind of incremental change is possible. And politics is supposed to be the art of the possible. And so I'm cautiously optimistic you'll start to see more of those incremental changes made.
So Washington, yes, the legislature has acted a couple of times on this. But Washington's main gift to all of this is the voters here. And frankly, this sounds funny, but the billionaires who supported Initiative 594. I was watching that. I was covering that. And it was fascinating to me to watch. That was the background check measure that passed by 60%. In 2014 by the voters of Washington. We're kind of leaders on that. And what was fascinating to me, I was watching the money that was coming in, and it was our homegrown billionaires here who, it was like a roll call. They were every week another billionaire, a Gates, a Ballmer, a Paul Allen, a Nick Hanauer, who was behind it, were popping in $1 million to support that. It was like they all agreed almost to do this. And if you interviewed the NRA at the time, which I, you know, the local folks on that, they were defeated before this thing started, before the actual election really got underway, because there was so much money on the other side. And then the voters spoke.
What legislation do you expect to come out of that in Washington State?
Well, there's another initiative. Signatures are being gathered for an initiative that resembles a bill that was passed by lawmakers in California. And what it is a restraining order. You go into court like other restraining orders, and if you have a family member who seems dangerous to himself or herself and others, you can prevent that person from having a gun for a year. That's a pretty darn good idea. If you transport Omar Mateen and his wife here under that rule, she would have had that option to go into court and say, I think he's kind of dangerous. We've been looking at places where he can shoot a lot of people. That would have been helpful.
You know, but the civil commitment statute kind of already does that. I mean, when you're committed under the Civil Commitment Act, you can't have access to firearms.
If you're committed, though, and what
this is
Joni's
easier.
Talking
this
about.
Is a lot
it sounds
easier.
Like the same
right.
standard.
It's not the same standard in the sense that civil commitment itself is a civil process that gets you committed. There's a judge that oversees it. What Joni's talking about is different in the sense that someone doesn't have to be a judge to be mentally ill, a danger to themselves or others. But instead, like it's more like a domestic violence situation, right? Where you get a protective order because of the threat of domestic violence. You get a restraining order, for example, no contact order. It's closer to that, although you're right, in extreme cases it can lead to civil commitment, Jossie, and then you do have those rules kick in.
So California lawmakers passed this, and that's where I think that's where these folks got this idea. Makes sense to me.
So Jossie, were you telling me that you think this talk about this this initiative and this background check misses a more important point?
Well, I think that there's a couple of more important points. Number one is, unfortunately, and we were talking about this earlier and seemed all in agreement that there was, you know, the impetus for these conversations is always some tragedy, number one. And that's unfortunate. But number two is that empirically, the vast, vast, vast majority of gun deaths happen as the result of handguns and not automatic, you know, AR-15s, even though that seems to be the face of evil right now. This does harm. This kills people. But the vast majority are done by handguns. And I think it's something like in 2012, it was like 11,000 handgun deaths to like 300, which is all rifle deaths across the nation, 300 to 11,000. And so unless there's some tidying up and tightening up of the access to handguns specifically, I think that unfortunately we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Absolutely. We can talk about collateral attacks on people's access to guns. However, that's assuming that all guns are created equally and harming people, and that's just not true. We need to somehow shore up the access that people have to handguns, which are killing the vast majority of people.
Mm. I think that the challenge here, Bill, is that the policymakers are trying to find a balance between limiting access to firearms for people who can't be responsible with them and not going so far as to prohibiting access to weapons by responsible people. And that's not an easy balance to strike.
But don't you think we've spent too much time on that side of the equation, clearly?
You know, the pendulum goes back and forth. So, you know, there was an assault weapons ban that was allowed to expire. It was a hot political issue back
and
in the 90s. Is evidence that it did work. That's
yes.
Right. So you might see consideration of that ban. And the reason for that is notwithstanding Jossie's, correct point that handguns kill, you know, are responsible for more deaths, is the fact that when you have someone who can fire so rapidly and so much and massacre so many people in such a short time, it draws attention to the question of, is it really necessary for people to have access to those kinds of large magazines, to those kinds of weapons in order for them to, enjoy the constitutional right to bear a weapon?
Well, let's talk about what the Senate tried to do, what some senators tried to do this week in Congress. In fact, Patty Murray was one of those Democratic senators who came to the floor. There was a 15-hour, I guess not technically a filibuster. NPR did a piece about that, but a sort of a big, long protest, a call for Republicans to bring these two gun control measures to a vote. Here's some of Patty Murray talking about it.
It sickens me, actually, that in America today, parents have to wonder if their children will be safe when they send them off to school or when they go to a movie theater or a mall or even in a street in their own neighborhood. Every time there is a new mass shooting, I hear the same questions from the people I represent in Washington State. What is Congress going to do to stop this? And it frustrates me that every time I come back with the same answer, we've been blocked from doing anything in response to my constituents and the people across the country. People who are asking and begging for us to do something, anything.
So let me start with Rob McKenna. Rob, you speak Republican. Are Republicans in Congress way out of step with what Americans are clamoring for?
Well, many of them represent states where they're not way out of step with their constituents. They might be out of step with some of Patty Murray's constituents. They might be out of step with, you know, people from, you know, blue states in the metropolitan areas. But, you know, they may come from red states where the idea of severely restricting access to firearms would be wildly unpopular. So it depends on what part of the country you come from. And it also depends in part on the ideology that you bring. But at the same time, you see Republicans from who are more moderate from states that are purple or even blue stepping up. The senator from Illinois, for example, Mark Kirk. And starting to say, you know,
which includes Chicago. So that's a big darn point.
Exactly. So, you know, now you're seeing him say, let's look at some of these ideas like banning access to firearms to people who are on these FBI watch lists.
Is there a gulf between, because maybe in my business in the media, maybe we exaggerate this, but is there a gulf between gun rights advocates and gun control advocates that is too wide for us to ever cross? Like, do we have Do we have so much? Are we demonizing each other so that we're locked up about what to do about guns? Or is that just no? It's inevitable. You can't tell people what to do with their stuff, and so they'll oppose that. And is there a cultural us them that should be dealt with around this?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there is a real, tangible, ideological, and also geographical, which is very important. Geography plays a big role in these conversations, as Rob correctly said regarding these red states. Well, a lot of them have large rural areas. And in those rural areas, I'm originally from the Blackfeet Indian Reservation in Browning, Montana, which is 1.7 million acres of absolutely beautiful geography and beautiful people, handsome, well-spoken, all
real likable.
Like you.
That's right. Yeah,
like
modest. You. But you know, on that huge expanse of land, guns are very prevalent because, lo and behold, you're not likely to shoot somebody if you accidentally discharge. Whereas if you live in Seattle, in West Seattle on Del Ridge, there's a greater opportunity. And so those facts, I think it's hard to have empathy toward a person that lives a completely different life and has a completely different cultural worldview. And coming from both of those worldviews, having lived in both of those worldviews, it's a tangible difference. Absolutely.
I'm going to do it here. I'm going to bring up the Trump.
It is 12:23.
Thank you for noting that. So I had a question. As all this is unfolding, and maybe Rob McKenna is right, and maybe some moderate Republicans are coming around, and maybe next week, although no, very few people are predicting actual success on gun safety in Congress, but somehow we're all supposed to be all jazzed because Donald Trump is going to meet with the NRA. As if, like, so my question is, why does the NRA control this? I thought he was going to be such an amazing leader and deal maker. I mean, who's telling who how this is going to go down?
Well,
a major leader would tell the NRA how it was going to happen, not the NRA telling us. Are they Congress?
He's probably talking to the NRA because they have a lot of influence with Congress, not just Republicans, but some Democrats as well. And he's trying to get them to a position where they won't threaten the political lives of Republicans and conservative Democrats who support some sort of gun control. I think that's what he's doing.
Well, clearly, but
I would like to think that. I'm not. I think we're giving him a little bit too much credit here, though.
Yeah, but who's in charge here? I mean, who is telling who how we're going to do this? To me, it's kind of it's backwards. It's backwards.
Well, he's just meeting with them, right?
He's probably trying to get. I think to Jossie's point, he's probably trying to get political cover for himself.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, that's a fair point. It's probably number one on his list. But you know, look, this is about whether or not there's going to be leadership in Congress or not. And here's the problem with Congress today. This perfectly illustrates the problem is that incumbents are much more afraid of their own party, their own base, than they are of the other party. And the reason, of course, as we all know, is that most legislative or most congressional districts are safe districts. People aren't facing real competition when they run for re-election from the other party. They may face challenges from within their own party. And so they've spent a lot more time worrying about being criticized for working across the aisle, for appearing not to be progressive enough or not to be conservative enough. They're going to draw a primary challenge. And this is where the vacuum of leadership in Congress starts. That's why it's so important for people like Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, Republican, and Mark Kirk from Illinois, and Susan Collins from Maine to cross the aisle and say, we're going to work together and we're going to compromise. We're going to have a hand in writing these bills. We're not just going to vote for what the Democrats write, but we're going to work towards that common end, for example, of banning access to weapons for people on the watch list. That needs to happen. We just do not see enough leadership of that type, that kind of courage, often enough in Congress today. And it has to start with the individuals who are actually serving there.
Is the Senate actually going to pass either of these two votes that are going
to be? That's anybody's guess. We don't know. The idea is if enough people. So first, their current approach where nobody, they just dig in, doesn't work. Congress is a failure on this issue, a complete failure.
Yeah.
It's left to the states. It's left to the local governments. That's what it is. So I can't actually predict because I don't have a great vote count. But it does seem that there's a moment here, unfortunately, has to follow one of these. It's just a sort of an awful way that this plays out every single time. There's a chance, not a big one.
Okay. So whether or not you think that there are bigger fish to fry around this, the two little guppies in Patty Murray's worldview would be the terrorist watch list and expanded background checks, and they're going to vote. There's going to be some kind of vote next week. Before we leave that, Washington State already did that, expanded background checks. Do we have such clear experience here that Patty Murray can wave that sheet of paper and say it's working this way?
Well, apparently something like 50 felons have been barred from buying guns. And that is, you know, that's preventative. And so you don't know what they would have done had they received those guns. But that sounds like progress to me. It's not a huge number, but it's a notable one.
Okay, well, we'll find out. I want to bring up one more gun topic, if I may, because someone brought up the question of semi-automatic rifles being something that you can just keep on shooting, right? And Moda, you can shoot 100 people, as it happened in Orlando. I want to talk now about a shotgun that was fired not very many times in Seattle in 2014. After a long court fight this week, King County released surveillance video of the shooting, fatal shooting at Seattle Pacific University. And what you see in this video, and we'll talk about why this is the subject of a court fight, what you see in the video that we now have, as I've watched it, is the gunman walks into Otto Miller Hall at SPU. We've all driven past it if we haven't been in it. And he shoots a student whose face is blurred in the video. The student staggers, doesn't fall. She was not killed. He had already killed somebody outside that hall before the video starts. Then when the shooter stops to reload his shotgun, because it wasn't a semi-automatic rifle with 30 rounds, a student security guard pepper sprays him, tackles him, pulls the gun away from him, runs away with the gun. The shooter's on the ground, and after rolling around for a while, starts to take out a knife, and the security guard comes back and disarms him again. So first of all, Joni, why was there a court fight over our ability to watch that video?
Well, the idea was that it was, you know, something that people didn't want to relive and re-see, and there certainly is an argument there. I'm going to end up on the other side of that argument because I think, look, when these things happen, who's on the front page? The shooter. We see him. I'm not sure we're glorifying him or her, but sometimes it does seem like that. But why not show, in this case, the hero, to give people a different example of how people could conduct themselves if somebody is horribly caught in one of these situations? And if you remember, it's about a year ago, three Americans were on a train, Paris to Brussels or Brussels to Paris, and they overwhelmed somebody who showed up on the train with a rifle and I think a box knife. There was this. They stopped it. Their mind went to, we can prevent this. I don't mind showing that, and you can always turn off your TV if you feel like it anytime.
Anybody disagree?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I get and I appreciate the concept of not showing the bad actor in that situation. I think that's an important thing, that we don't glorify these folks who do horrible acts. However, I do think it's dangerous. I actually think it's dangerous to show these heroic acts as if it's somehow going to be instructive. In this moment, I'm going to do this. This is in no way instructive to me. That it's an anomaly. That's the reason why police officers are trained extensively in situations with multiple traumas going on around them, because there's no telling how you're going to act. Me, I would probably scream and cry, being honest. And so for me to say, well, as a result of this action,
This guy was a security guard.
That somehow this is going to be instructive and somebody's going to be the hero in a situation if it's at a bank or something like that. I think it puts that person who might take that as instructive, it puts them in a position of maybe greater danger and in fact, probably greater danger than they otherwise would have been.
So you got the shooter, you got the victims, and you got the shooter, you got the hero, and then you got the victims. And well, my mind went to the victims of the shooting or other shootings where there's video, because I worry about re-victimizing them or re-traumatizing them by publicly releasing images of them being shot or knifed or what have you.
How much does it matter that their faces are indistinguishable in the video?
That does matter. At the same time, they know they're on the video. So I'm not saying that that's an absolute bar to releasing video like this. I just think that needs to be factored in, and perhaps it was factored into the consideration of the judge in this case. It ought to be, because we should be concerned about these people who, after all, were the ones who were traumatized or injured by the event.
Do you think the victim should have a say in whether the video is real? Because we had this legal question. It's like it's a media law question, right?
Even though, yes, I think the answer is yes, they should. Even though when you're out in public and you're captured on footage by a security camera, you have no expectation of privacy, right? No reasonable expectation of privacy. So it's not like your privacy rights are being violated. Instead, it's a matter of compassion.
That's right.
Compassion for the victim and letting them weigh in to say, hey, this would really hurt me and re-victimize me and cause further trauma if it were publicly released.
So I really don't know how this goes. Is a judge supposed to compassionately figure in the state of mind of the victim in a media law case where they're deciding
whether
the legal training to know if whether that plays into
it's a
legal
balance.
Decision to release on a public record.
I'd call it a balance of equities weighing the equities in the case. It is a little tricky for the judge here because if you're talking about footage from a publicly owned camera, it is a public record and it is supposed to be disclosed. Having said that, if the judge says, I'm just not going to do it because this is going to hurt a lot of people, fine, take it up on appeal. But I doubt that would happen. I think the judge's ruling would probably stand in that case.
Yeah, I think.
But keep in mind that this was a security guard that decided to intervene. That's actually this person's job, took the risk, saw the moment, and set an example.
Yeah. But once again, to take that as instructive, you know, that somebody that's not a security guard, that this can be an inspiration for somebody to play the hero, I think that could be troubling. Moreover, I do think that the question of, you know, whether this person's identity is re-traumatizing, that's a subjective question of that particular individual. Maybe they're, you know, the rising YouTube singer and they want the exposure. Who knows? But if they choose not to, I think that outside of the right to the reasonable expectation of privacy, which there is none on a street, it's a moral question.
Is it morally wrong to watch the video once you have the opportunity?
I think that there's I think that's a larger question of, you know, that we might ask in regards to a lot of the images we see on television now where people put themselves in very vulnerable states and see them on television. I personally kind of take my son away from watching that sort of stuff. Yes.
And I've noticed a lot of the broadcasts now will say we have very graphic images coming. Yes. So if there are young people in the room, take cover, basically.
I want to read a bit of a statement from this security guard. I don't really know. I don't think he minds his name being released, you know, the hero. His name is John Meese. And he's the guy with the pepper spray who released this statement. Among other things, he said, I would encourage that hate be met with love. When I came face to face with the attacker, God gave me the eyes to see that he was not a faceless monster, but a very sad and troubled young man. While I cannot at this time find it within me to forgive his crime, I truly desire that he will find the grace of God and the forgiveness of our community.
Wow.
He's a remarkable guy.
That's amazingly compassionate. Yeah.
Yeah. So why not show that? Why not tell that? Why not discuss that?
Did any of you have a what would I have done in this situation? I honestly, whether it's right or wrong, I watched it more than once and tried to figure out when is the point at which I could be that guy in that situation and rush this man.
Yeah, and it caused me to think. You know, would I have the instincts and the fortitude to step in like that, or would the instinct for self-preservation kick in instead? Which is how most people would respond. In the Orlando nightclub shooting, most people were interviewed. People said, "I got the hell out of there as fast as I could," which was exactly the right thing for them to do.
That's right.
Yeah, my kids would like me to come home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's the rush toward the fire and the rush away. I mean, people have faced this for a very long time.
And maybe I should be trained in how to use pepper spray in case I or somebody else is in danger. And I've known that my whole life, and I've never done it. And I think I took CPR training about 30 years ago and vaguely remember. You know, like we can, you started out this hour, Jossie, talking about our own accountability.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, you know, you, me, talking to myself, and you, the listener, you can do something. You can do more than nothing about this.
It was a wonderful use of pepper spray, if you think about it. So good to have it around sometimes.
Here's an example of something you could do that wouldn't put you in immediate danger, but could make a big difference. If you become aware that someone is thinking of taking a violent action, you can speak up about it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a student who's aware that another student's about to be bullied or seriously hurt, if you're an adult who has a family member who you realize is unstable, for God's sake, speak up about it. One thing about all of these incidents is that and the repeated pattern of people who are seriously unstable conducting these shootings is that there are people around them who are aware of it. And it takes courage. It takes fortitude to go report it. But that's something anyone can do. If they can bring themselves to do it. Everyone should be able to do.
Maybe you're digging that initiative that they're gathering signatures for right now.
Well, we'll talk later. I haven't actually read the text yet. But
in fact,
you've intrigued me.
In fact, thank you, Rob. Speaking up, it's a little different. You know, now you're talking about speaking up about someone else who you think is a danger. But that's exactly what I want to talk about next, is speaking up. Because in a whole bunch of different ways, this week, this month, these last, I don't know, couple few years, we'll talk about this. But I think there is a trend toward people who were silent, stop saying, I'm not going to be silent anymore. And I'd like to talk a little bit about what's going on when we come back on the Week in Review. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. We're with attorney and activist Jossie Ross, the host of Civic Cocktail, Joni Balter, former Washington Attorney General Rob McKenna, and we got this note on Twitter, by the way, that I mentioned. We are always live tweeting the program. We'd like to hear what you think. We brought up a lot of stuff in the last several minutes, and we'd like to hear your take, your story, your suggestions. We are on Twitter at KUOW. Someone listening to us, we were talking about this pepper spray using security guard, someone notifies us that really he's a student safety monitor. And I don't know completely the difference, but it is true. When you think security guard, you might think a higher level of training and armed and weapon than was the case with someone who was just told, here, I don't know what he was told, but he had some pepper spray and he was a student and his job was to keep his eyes open.
Well, maybe that's why this person had pepper spray and not straight-on weapons.
Yes.
You know, that helps you understand that. But
right.
That was a useful tool in this case.
Thanks for listening and for live tweeting with us at KUOW. So as I was saying a moment ago, in the last year or so, I've noticed something. It seems relatively new to me. People trying to banish shame and silence. And this week, it's been this theme, the shooting of 100 people at a gay nightclub. And we've talked about how far civil rights have come since gay people came out more and more to us. We have a state initiative being circulated about transgender rights. I interviewed a transgender man he said he's been doing awkward interviews where he's asked about his genitals and what he and his wife do in bed, but he's not going to be silent. Some women are accusing a Seattle man of tricking them into thinking they were auditioning for porn films. And these women are saying, yeah, I wanted to try being a sex worker. Sure, you can use my full name. And that's purposeful. Celebrities are talking about depression and mental illness and drug addiction. Someone in my family committed suicide. I'm an atheist. That I've never told anyone. This is what my miscarriage was like. I was raped. The premier of British Columbia just said, I want to talk about the fact that somebody tried to sexually assault me when I was 13 years old, and we're not going to be silent anymore. A Seattle writer got heat for starting a campaign called Shout Your Abortion, where women tell their stories of abortions. I could go on. So first of all, do you think that I'm right that this is a real and significant trend? Maybe it was ever thus.
Well, I think that there's more of a share your pain kind of culture today than there was years ago.
And maybe for better or for worse, but let's talk about that. What do you mean by that?
Better for worse. What I mean is people want to tell you, their illness, their victimhood, just to kind of tell you where they're coming from in some ways. And I don't have a problem with it. I think it's more transparency about who people are. And I think that it also, if you think about it, there's a safety component to some of this, because in the case of the BC premier, if you're talking about being molested at age 13, it's probably better to, if you can get to that comfort level, to share that, because maybe you save someone else from that same experience. I don't know what happened.
Or at least being ashamed about having gone through that.
Or that too. But I'm more into outing whoever did that so that you could stop them.
Mm-hmm. This reminds me of the trend we've seen over the last probably decade at least of people in the public eye coming forward to talk about experiences they've had with illnesses, like cancer,
mm-hmm.
in order to encourage other people to go for early screening, for example. Even though sometimes, many times, talking about these experiences or the experiences of a loved one who's actually passed away from cancer can be really painful because it means reliving some of that experience. It's really valuable, right? I mean, it's been really good. And it encourages people to be more aware of their own health and what they should be doing to protect it. And perhaps those examples have encouraged people to come forward to talk about other really difficult experiences with the same hope that people who have had that experience or who could maybe avoid it if they were warned will be alerted to it. And so I was trying to think of a counterexample of where, well, it's a bad thing this person spoke up about this experience they had. They shouldn't have talked about it. And I honestly couldn't come up with a counterexample. All the examples you gave, are even though they're going to be make some people really uncomfortable, are examples that I can see the value in, actually.
That's the value of storytelling.
Absolutely.
Right. That's the value of storytelling, is we're supposed to evolutionarily point out, hey, don't go over there. There's a bear over there. It'll eat you.
That's true.
And, this is different manifestations of that ancient ritual of storytelling and giving survival stories and survivor stories. So, for example, the young lady who, there was the hubbub and, the Brock Turner, right? The rapist from Stanford.
Stanford University.
That's right. Not the former swimmer, as certain headlines said. The former swimmer. No, the rapist, Brock Turner. And the young lady put her story out there. To me, that was incredibly healing and cathartic. Not only for her, I'm sure, I haven't spoken to her, I don't know her personally, but for somebody else who says, I'm not crazy. I had this exact same experience. I'm not crazy. There's other people under this big old sky that have had this exact same experience, and she spoke out. I think that can be a powerful, emboldening, and empowering thing.
But as you said, that is ancient. So
yes.
What has stopped us, what still stops us so much then from, why is this remarkable that somebody would tell a story even of their own pain?
Well, it's remarkable when it involves a story that we haven't heard before, like your example of the sex worker apprentices who tried out for a porn film only to find out they're being victimized by the con man. Because what they're saying there is, I was trying to get into a business for which there's still a lot of social approbation, and I'm willing to talk about it anyway. And that's actually an example where if you start to carry it forward, let's say someone comes forward and says, well, I decided to try to be a prostitute and here's what happened to me. If they're doing it in order to warn people off of that activity, because I think prostitution is largely human trafficking, so that's good. If they come forward to tell a story that ends up being more of self-promotion and glorification, not that these women are doing that, but I'm saying hypothetically, then it starts to shade into self-aggrandizement and, if it involves glorifying a dangerous or inappropriate activity, then it becomes a problem.
Isn't that what stops people from telling their stories, that somebody might call it inappropriate? And well, now we're
yeah.
into...
Where's the line? Right?
Well,
I
think that
yeah, that's true.
I also think that there's a component that we have to look at the means of distribution of those stories. So, for example, these stories have largely been, they've been filtered through wealthy white males who have access to mainstream means of media. And now with blogs, with alternate forms of what they call new media, well, those stories can get out. Those stories, it's a little bit more egalitarian, where people outside of who didn't have access to those traditional channels of communication can get out. And so one of the examples that I like to use of that is of, people who say, well, Native Americans, for example, have only recently began protesting mascots that they thought were degrading. Well, no, there's a lot of people who have said that, but they didn't necessarily have access to the traditional channels, similar to the way that, some folks say, well, abolitionists started the abolition movement. No, that's not true. Black folks had opposed slavery for a very long time, but, nobody listened. So it's also a matter of who's listening and how much access do you have to those channels of communication.
And those non-mainstream sources, they normalize those stories, and then the mainstream media picks it up, and then suddenly it's common conversation.
It will become safer, right? Because if you see it published in social media or elsewhere, then it becomes a signal that it's okay for me to talk about it too, to your point, Bill.
And in the case of the women that you referred to who thought they were going to be porn stars, they're doing this, I presume, as a warning to others. I mean, pay attention. And that's what the stories are good for, to warn others or to make others feel okay. A very good friend of mine, Michael Kinsley, has Parkinson's. He wrote about, he didn't tell folks for 10 years. He's had it 25 years.
Right.
But then he wrote about it. He wrote about it in Time magazine. He wrote a book about it. And he's been, living a fairly decent life while having Parkinson's, making other people feel like, I understand what you're going through. And then look at how, you know, how I'm handling it, and maybe they feel a little better. So,
and so here's the key: is that he made the decision.
He did.
He wasn't
he
outed,
did.
So to speak, as a person with Parkinson's, and that should it should always be the decision of the person who comes forward that they it was their free will and their desire to help that motivated them to do it.
Well, some people have said, "I'm going to out somebody for a larger purpose against the will of that one person for the benefit of the many."
But they all
you
work
agree
for
or
doctor,
not,
right?
But they all work. Okay, one last thing: is anyone going to speak up for silence? Jossie, I remember you criticizing McLemore for talking about white privilege, putting his own experience front and center. That's not the same as shame, but it's still, do we sometimes talk too much?
I don't think it's a question of, I think that the difference is what the former attorney general said, and that it's people speaking for themselves. So in McLemore's situation, it was him speaking for another group, right? And that's questionable. That's dangerous, because then we have sometimes the thing of championing and possibly co-opting. And we have to be very careful about permission, about disclosure, about saying our own positions of privilege within that conversation. When it's somebody choosing of their own volition, agency, and self-determination that I'm going to put this story, as uncomfortable as it might be, as painful as it might be, I'm going to put this story up, and I might be judged, I might be criticized, but I'm willing to do that for the edification or of emboldenment or empowerment of other people. I can't critique that decision. That's something that, to me, even though I might not personally want to put myself in that space, they made a decision, and I respect them.
We're going to talk in a moment about a disclosure that just happened about cameras that are on your local utility pole. And then we're going to ask if it's okay to be judgy about $40 dog cakes on a Frisbee. I promise. Stay tuned. Yes. With Rob McKenna, Jossie Ross, and Joni Balter, I'm Bill Radke. This week, a federal judge said Seattle City Light may not tell you where there are FBI cameras and other surveillance equipment hidden on Seattle utility poles. A group called Center for Open Policing filed a public disclosure request, and the judge said that turning over this information about what cameras on your local utility pole could damage national security or hurt law enforcement interests. Let me start with former Attorney General Rob McKenna. Rob, what's the law here on whether you can expect for there not to be a government hidden camera on your local utility pole?
There is no law to prevent a government hidden camera on your utility pole any more than there's a law banning a hidden camera put up by a retailer or by your next door neighbor. If it's on their property or on property they have legal access to, there's no expectation of privacy. You don't have a right not to be filmed by a camera when you're walking down the street in a public forum any more than you would have a right to have someone not film you with their iPhone walking down the street because they're a tourist. That's just the way the law works in the public forum.
Or should you have a right to know where the camera is
No, you don't, because again, you don't know where the cameras are that your neighbors have mounted on their property, where the retailers have mounted in stores to prevent shoplifting and so forth.
So let's face it, there are cameras absolutely everywhere. And the judge is right in this case. There's no reason to jeopardize these FBI investigations. We don't know what they are exactly. It would be great to know what they are, but we don't.
And you don't have a right to know what they are.
Well, and remember, the issue in this case wasn't really about public's right not to be filmed by the FBI. It was about whether or not the city of Seattle had to release the location information under the public records law,
since,
of course, they keep public records of where these cameras are located. Mm-hmm. And here, Judge Jones, the federal judge, concluded that national security interests trump the State Public Records Act.
And you said Trump, but I'm just going to say that I
he's
think,
ruined well, that word. Damn him.
So I'm just going to say that I agree with that. I'm a journalist. Of course, I like full disclosure on just about everything. But in this case, the sort of, you know, weighing the overriding interest, you have to end up on the side of the FBI conducting these investigations. This guy, I don't really get what he needs the location of the cameras for. And he should be aware that people are filming these stores everywhere. There's cameras everywhere.
It reminds me.
So in a way, we don't need, you don't need to know where the camera is because it's on you.
Because it's on
just
you.
Assume, that's kind
just
of the
count
point.
On it. Just count on it.
It's sort of the point.
Pretend you're a candidate for political office and assume you're being filmed and recorded at all times.
Yeah. There that's kind go. Of the world. That's Minority it. Report, right? I certainly have concerns about, you know, I mean, historically, FBI has had somewhat of a antagonistic relationship with a lot of Native communities and other communities as well. And we can talk about the propriety or impropriety of that. But, yeah, I mean, there's a legal basis for it, and there's just no expectation of privacy. You're on public land.
I did have a flashback, though, when I read this story, to when I was attorney general and an incarcerated inmate who was notorious for filing public records requests. I mean, thousands of public records requests per year, demanded that King County turn over as a public record all of the footage from the security cameras at the doors to the courthouse.
That's our footage, Mr. Attorney General.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Right. I'm sure he had all kinds of beneficent uses in mind, but the public record law was on his side in that case, so we went and got the law changed, which is what you should do.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's a question of law. Okay, is the law wrong or right? That's a different question than the administration of the law, and this is pretty clear.
Okay, so then do we all assume that we're being
videotaped
at all times?
Yeah. All
yes,
time.
Indeed, at all times. Yeah.
Now,
the drones could be, you know, a weird new tangent for this, because that could be like above your house or something.
Yeah, right. It's different.
You don't see that.
You have an expectation of privacy in your own home.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. How about your yard?
Not really.
Definitely in
where
my
drones
yard.
Can, drones
definitely
can
in my yard.
You don't, no.
In plain
unfortunately.
Sight.
Yeah.
All right, and everyone's okay with it. By the way, we've microchipped our guests. We have a lot of people. We were live tweeting at KOW. A lot of folks want to know, where do your guests go after the program is over? What do they do? So you can go to our...
it'll be a little map that'll be on the KOW website with little lights following us.
Just follow me on Glimpse if you don't have that app yet.
Right? I don't have Glimpse. I didn't know you were constantly tracked on that.
That's what parents are doing to their kids now with those new apps, right?
That's right.
So join us at KOW.org/ Where's Rob McKenna Now? KOW's Week in Review. We know what you're feeding your dog, and we will judge you coming up on Week in Review. I wish I could simultaneously host this show and be reading the Twitter feed about the show, because our social media producer, Kara, tells us there's a good discussion going on at KUOW. Meanwhile, let's continue it at microphone, okay? With Joni Baltard, Rob McKenna, and John C. Ross. I'm Bill Radke. Did you all know that there are pet food trucks? Did everybody know
I did
that?
Not know that.
No.
Why wouldn't there be?
I didn't know, but yeah, exactly. Why wouldn't there be? Seattle has been dog crazed for a really long time.
And food truck craze. Hence
and food
the
truck.
Combination of these.
Right.
And usually when you think of a truck and a dog coming together, it's a bad thing. But in this way, it's a delicious thing.
So now we know the answer to the question. What happens when the dog finally catches the truck? If it's a food truck?
It eats a baked good.
Exactly.
And you all know this, that there are more dogs than children in Seattle. This is a fact.
I think that story.
I broke
Joni.
That story. Thank you for remembering that.
Yeah.
It was the hardest thing in the world, because obviously we know from the census how many children there are. We know this. Mm. But what we didn't know is how many dogs, because only a percentage of people license their dogs. This formula drove me crazy. I sat there for like a week working on this, and I ended up having to deal with the dog food companies, and then some crazy factor of that mixed with percentage of licenses. And
oh, so they know.
And so it begins.
There's an algorithm for that.
Apparently.
You know, there's another algorithm, and that is that Seattle is one of the whitest cities in the United States. And I think this goes along. I go on my Instagram.
Jossie, will you finish that thought after I tell listeners what in the world we're talking about? I just want to tell, in case because I haven't mentioned yet,
context.
The Seattle Times did
a
piece about a food truck called Seattle Barkery. See, it's like bakery, but dogs bark.
Yes.
Thanks.
So it's actually barkery.
I get it.
A handcrafted baked goods, high quality ingredients. I didn't know dogs wanted cream cheese frosting and bacon sprinkles served on a frisbee, but they do for $40. Yes, Jossie, white people.
White people, yes. So
and the dogs.
On my Instagram feed, I get a lot of white people that kiss their dogs. And so this seems like an absolutely logical conclusion.
You want them to eat well.
Right, exactly. Okay. okay, well, I'm kissing this dog, so I want to control what goes into its mouth, and it should
breath,
be
not dog breath.
That's right. It should be something gourmet and hopefully, you know, gluten-free, because I have that gluten allergy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes sense as a necessary next step to those facts, that empirical data that Seattle is one of the widest.
Wait. I just figured it out, guys. He's making fun of us.
Hey.
Whoa. Yes, he is. That's okay. Good.
Not me. I don't have a pet. I don't have a dog anyway. I got a cat that I don't pamper. But this is what I want to get to. Is it okay? Is it judgy to be judgy about what other people spend their money on?
It's too judgy.
Is it?
Too darn judgy. People can spend their money on whatever they want. I do want to know what's in that $40 cake, though.
You want to know?
Yeah.
All I can tell you.
I mean, I want to know.
Peanut butter, banana, coconut oil, gluten-free flour.
That's about $12 worth of ingredients.
Whipped cream cheese, bacon, sprinkle cake, and a Frisbee. Is it hypocritical to say that we need to fund our public schools and mental health system and homeless services and then spend $40 on the peanut butter, banana, coconut oil, gluten-free
flour?
No,
those are two different questions. One's of taxation and one's of discretionary spending. Yeah, and, you know, Seattle is an incredibly, affluent city. And that makes sense. We run out of things to spend money on, so let's.
But do we? Have we run out of things to spend money
on?
Because your dog could still get the love she needs.
I think
as
for
you
an $11 cake, I'm just thinking that would be pretty good.
As you take your dog on a walk to the food bank to give that $40 to some hungry, sad humans, your dog could still feel loved.
Oh, absolutely.
Is that judgy?
My dog isn't getting that.
Just putting it in an older Frisbee, apparently. An older Frisbee with less flash and less expensive ingredients.
It's entirely predictable that people will be judgy about that. I mean, people have been complaining about how much other people spend on their pets for a long, long time. And I mean, this is a biblical criticism, right? New Testament, right? Why are you spending money on these fancy oils? We should give it to the poor, right?
Yeah.
So this is not a new thing, but it's just good to see consistency in human nature over the millennia.
Yeah. We were judgy then. We're judgy now. Yeah. By the way, you're a runner, Rob. The Rock and Roll Marathon is this weekend.
Yeah.
Is it okay for me to want runners to just run around Green Lake 1,000 times and not get in my way? Is that too judgy?
Because that's going to close up the town just a tad.
That is a fun race. I've done the Rock and Roll Half Marathon 3 times.
But what does it have to do with me? I love that you run, but why can't you just...
Can't you keep it
not like, oh, you're like saying because it inconveniences you that I'm not there. Well,
Okay.
There's the answer.
There's your answer.
Ha ha. There's the quote.
In so many things, the answer is ha ha.
Yeah, that's right.
You've been listening to KOW's Week in Review. Rob McKenna, I wish you well in your tennis shoes. Thank you for coming. Joni Balter, Jossie Ross. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
To see you again. Thank you for joining us. We are at KOW, Facebook, KOW Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in.